You're listening to episode 14 of the GDPR Guy. Chat with Joey Stanford of platform.sh. Welcome to the GDPR Guy, the podcast dedicated to helping you comply with data privacy rules and regulations. I'm your host, Carl Gottlieb, Data Protection Officer and owner of the data protection consultancy firm Cognition. Each episode I'll be providing information, insights and inspiration to help you on your compliance journey. You'll find show notes and useful resources on the website thegdprguide.com as well as details for getting in touch with me directly. In this episode I had a live video chat with Joey Stanford, the DPO and security lead of the platform as a service provider platform.sh. We talked about how he handles a combined privacy and security role for such a complex environment and how he approaches the huge challenge of meeting all the compliance requirements of his global client base. Here's the audio of our chat. Hey everyone, I'm Carl Gottlieb and I'm joined by Joey Stanford today. How you doing, Joey?
You're good. Thanks very much.
Excellent. So we're live currently on YouTube and probably Twitter. Periscope, I doubt that'll work, but it never seems to. But it'd be nice to have something formal on there rather than the normal rubbish we have on Twitter. But we're going to plow through a load of stuff. We've got as much time, I guess, as Joey's got. It's 9:30 in the evening for me. So yeah, as long as I don't fall asleep, we'll be good. Joey is kind of weird in that he works in privacy and security and has got an incredibly varied background. One of the things I wanted to talk to you about, Joe, was you've got a project management background, which arguably is the most boring of all backgrounds you can have. But fortunately, you're not a lawyer, which most of my kind of colleagues are. So I'd love to kind of start off with your background and how you're finding what you do right now is really helped by that background you've got.
It's interesting. I do have an unusual path, I guess, to get here from applications developer to project manager and then into sort of security. And then as part of security, the privacy and compliance pieces came on after reading hundreds of contracts and caring about it. And I think that's probably the deep thing is caring. The project management background really helps in a sense because I can look at when you're a project manager, you think about taking, you have something you need to do, right? And you would normally build a statement of work, get a charter, build a statement of work, and then go through and figure out all the list of tasks. And that's really helpful in my job because then I can go look at something, you know, whether it's a new privacy law that's come in, a new requirement from customers, and then articulate the steps that needs to happen and then figure out who's going to work on them and what's the business justification for them and similar. So it's turned out really good because that way I don't have to necessarily rely on another project manager try to keep, although another project manager definitely helps to keep track of all the moving parts that are happening in the ecosystem.
So could you talk more about your specific role? So you work at Platform, is it pronounced platform.sh?
Yes, platform.sh.
What is the SH bit, first of all? What?
Well, it's sort of a joke. It has a couple different meanings, but you can think of SH like shell, so platform shell. So platform's interesting. Platform is a multi-cloud platform as a service. And the principal role for platform is to allow developers to take their website, their code, and push it immediately up and bypass the IT department. So we use the Git workflow, so the developers, which developers are really familiar with, they do Git push, it comes to us, we do all the magic in the background, and a couple seconds later, presto chango, they've got a website that's live on live to the world, and it eliminates the whole IT, it eliminates a lot of things, and we handle pretty much everything else. We handle all the security, we handle all the updates, all they need to do is focus on their code. So it really relieves a burden for not only developers, but corporations that have, they have this traditional IT infrastructure. They don't need to go off and manage. They don't have to go off to manage brick and mortar and the server in Building 6, and they don't have to manage just regular environments on like AWS or Google.
Fantastic. And you're the data protection officer, but you also, so you cover privacy, but you also cover parts of security as well. So that is, for a product company that is B2B in tech, that's huge. That's a lot of work.
Yeah, I have this really unusual title. I've never met anybody that has the same group. So my title officially is Security Compliance and Data Protection Officer. So if you unpack that, I have three separate job roles. I have the security piece. So I am an information security officer, and since I happen to be the only one, I am the chief information security officer. I can get into that in a second because I'm not technically the chief information security officer. And then I have the compliance mission, so the regular traditional compliance pieces of, you know, whether it's standards compliance with ISO, SOC 2, PCI, that sort of stuff. And then I have the data protection officer, which is true to form, the GDPR version of data protection officer, you know, where I'm registered in with my own supervisory authority, but also in the United Kingdom and in Germany and in Australia. And so it's really fun to mix those together. And it's unusual to put all those things into a bit, especially for a data protection officer, right? Because GDPR, when you get into the mix of it, you really want to separate the data protection officer away from everything else. They could provide, you know, independent advice. You know, they're not right. And you're not basically auditing yourself, which makes for a great conversation, by the way, because if you are, you know, hey, I think we should do this. Okay, I think I agree too. Okay, that's good to bet. But the way that I structure that today internally is I have a security team, and I have a compliance team. And for the security component, I split the true CISO framework with my CTO, who's an amazing gentleman. I think he's got an eidetic memory, and so he takes the real heavy duty technical components of the product, and he focuses on the security there. And he's really good at doing that. And then I step back and I look at, for the most part, the organizational aspects and the compliance side, like the standards compliance of that. And so we end up discussing a lot of different things, and he'll say, hey, I think we should do this, and I think that's great. I'll say, hey, we should do this. He does the same thing. The interesting conversations are when you have an external standard, you know, like a SOC 2 or a PCI that says, here's the requirement, and this is what you need to do to solution that requirement. And we get into these really interesting conversations about does this requirement really apply to us? And if it does, what's the actual avenue? And then once we kind of understand that, then we have to go in to find out whether or not the requirement that the standard is asking actually fits into our somewhat unique business model. So a case in point, as an example, would be for PCI says you need to have anti-malware running on all of your systems. Right? So what does that really mean when you're looking at a read-only Linux containerized environment? You know, you can't, you know, if you put, how does that work? What is it? What's the background for that? How much resources does it use? Is it really relevant? Does it really actually do anything in that case, right? And we had a really wonderful discussion about what does it really mean to us? And our thought process was, well, let's go back to first principles. Let's look at containment models. What is our containment model? And how would you break out of that? And what would set off alarms if something happened? And so we built a system for that. And so that was kind of interesting. Anyway, that's the security side. And then I have a separate, and so my security team is technical in nature. And they handle the traditional security incidents, but they're a large portion of their work, and the same with my corresponding non-technical compliance team, is to handle typically standards compliance and legal compliance. And so we have a little joke internally that it takes two to make a thing go right. Right? We have the non-technical compliance and we have the technical security, and we put them together because when you look at standards and even laws, even GDPR that just references things like technical and organizational, right, measures, TOMS, you really need to, it's two separate skill sets. You really need to have both of these skill sets to find the solution to the problem in the best way. And so that's kind of how I address things, is they spend most of their time in that, those two pockets, adhering to a third party standard.
Yeah. Now, one of the things I just want to pick up on from that is you said about the kind of the CISO, not CISO kind of role. And as many people kind of watching this, listening, will know, you have the simplistic view of the world from places like ISO 27001, where it says, okay, you can have security officers, but they all report to a CISO. So it's that kind of really simple kind of one person at the top approach. How have you kind of carved that out? Have you got a CISO role in the exec, but a kind of day-to-day CISO in you?
So the nice thing is that we split it. And with that, we try to help reduce conflict of interest in there. So I guess the answer to the question, a good way to answer that question. So my CTO and myself both sit roughly at the same level. He's one level above me, and he sits on the executive team. And so we both have some nice, we both have like VP level titles, but he actually sits on the executive team. And so when we look at who's responsible for like the ISO 27000 example, you have a single person and that person's responsible for everything. We established a partnership very early on so that we could share that load, keep each other honest, and not burden a single person with everything. Now we both, the nice part about it is that we both chime in on 80% maybe of all of the topics that go in. And we just have carved out separate little pieces so that we know that it's being done right. And then as we get through certification, we go through certification pathways and audits in particular, we then check all of these different pieces, the pieces that he's responsible for, the pieces that I'm responsible for, to make sure that we're still doing it right.
I really like that kind of approach because it's kind of a real world approach that actually works. And one of the very few good things about PCI is it has that kind of concept of, well, hey, if this is a stupid thing and it's not relevant to you or you can't afford it, then you can find some kind of mitigating alternative to do that. Of course, there are exceptions, but with things like a DPO where it has to be a nominated person, a CISO probably, I assume, within ISO 27001 is a role rather than a person. So therefore, it allows you to turn that into something more dynamic, like a few people. I remember in the days of antivirus work I was doing a while back, where when the next-gen AV companies came along, like Cylance and a few others, a load of customers were coming to them, and I was consulting for them at the time, and they said, we can't take our laptop into this military base in the UK because they have to check the AV is up to date. So they're looking for the signature file. They said, but there isn't one. So how can we prove it's up to date? So they actually had to release a version change that showed today's date on the product, even though there's no DAP file or anything. So I can understand where you're coming from, where you sort of, you've got that kind of requirement and you're finding a practical thing that works. It's helping your customers and ultimately helping kind of all of us.
You still have that problem, by the way, today, because you have behavioral scanners, behavioral antivirus, which I really like as opposed to signature based. And they don't have signature updates. And so how do you convince PCI that this is not only good, but it's actually better than the way that the standard's written?
Now, going on from there, that kind of approach of like, this is what we've been told, or this is what's going on, this is what I think needs to be done, that kind of real talk thing, how does that kind of manifest in your world? Because you've got a lot of things going on and you've got huge amounts of outside pressure from clients that are saying, I know we're a business in Brazil with this regulation, or we're a company in Italy and we expect this. You must do it for us. And you've got people inside saying, I want this, I want that, I want that. How do you kind of manage that on a personal level? You know, with, is it real talk? Is it calmness? Is it, you know, getting a bit of your New York side out of you sometimes?
The correct answer, I think, would be none of those. The way I approach things is, So when you're in a privacy or even security, right, your principal focus is risk. And the way that you balance, there's a couple ways of balancing risk, but you take risk and you associate it with the commercial drivers, the revenue, the contracts that are coming in, those sort of things. And so what you end up looking for, the way to say, hey, there's something risky, we should do something about it, you always tie that back, whether it's security or compliance, you tie that back into revenue, because you can't have, for example, in security, you cannot do more security and more security activities and spend more on the security budget than you actually, that's commercially feasible. It just doesn't work, right? They're tied together. That's really the whole the information security management sort of role is to how do you make that balance? Where do you determine the risks? And so what I've done And it seems to work really well for me. Your mileage may vary. But what I do is I look at what the commercial drivers are. Do we operate in a jurisdiction, like say France, that requires us to adhere to a standard, or sorry, a regulation like GDPR? Do I have a client that's coming in that wants to have, they want us to be PCI certified, they want us to be SOC 2, they want XYZ. And so then I look at those, and then I figure out what the revenue difference is there. I mean, do we need it? Do we need something just flat out because we have to stay in business, like GDPR, you kind of need it if you want to be in business, or is it optional? And then if it's optional for a customer, what's the return on investment for that? You know, will we recoup our funds? Will we be able to sell into bigger markets? Will we be able to get, more customers for this that will eventually reduce the overall cost for us, right? And then there's actually a hidden cost in there, which is a very big driver, which is if you don't have a certification, but other businesses that use your product do, they will often submit a massive amount of support tickets asking for evidence while they're going through their audits. And so by just having a certification that you can hand to somebody, you can reduce not only your own audit burden, but the audit burden of your clients as well. So commercial driver.
That last point is a fascinating one. The rest of it was quite interesting, but that last point is fascinating because friction isn't something you ever really hear being discussed in, especially in the privacy world. It's all about ROI. It's all about, actually, no, forget that. It's rarely about ROI in the privacy world. It's more in the security world because security's had that burden for years of security is a cost on the business, not worth doing. There's never an ROI, that kind of thing, unless you're a B2B company in which you can start to scrape something out. But even that's fairly immature. But in the privacy world, it's just, hey, it's a cost of compliance, deal with it. Yeah, friction is a huge thing that not many people measure. You're not really measuring the cost of support tickets. And the fact you're measuring that and turning it into like a business case is kind of fascinating. We're seeing vendors, we're seeing a lot of people look into the vendor management, customer management world, how to reduce the friction of RFIs, RFPs, and so on. You must get that all the time, those ridiculously long things that, you're not even going to win the deal. They're just filling in a form.
Yep. And the only way to deal with those really is to automate them. At some point, the volume and the complexity exceeds the amount you're willing to pay on manpower to do that. And then there's the other component to this, which is if you've got new people that you're training up, they may not give the exact answer you want, and which sets potentially could set an incorrect expectation on the behalf of the client that you're doing. So automation tools are very useful in that because it allows you to have a knowledge base by which you will, that it pre-fills like 80% of these RFP requests, I think. And then it allows you to go through and look at those and allows you to update your back-end knowledge base and reapply the information you do on a regular basis. So it's generally always fresh and you always have the same standard forward-facing answer.
Are there any tools you could recommend? Please feel free to plug them because there's many people watching, listening to this, that will be like in that same pain point.
So there are a couple, like in the RFP realm, the one that I personally favor, not an endorsement from my company, the one that I personally favor is Loopio. Because Loopio is as close to pure magic as you can get. You upload a file, it searches your database, pre-fills everything, allows you to send off bits and pieces like, oops, this is a security component. Let's get the security team involved. And it maintains a back-end database. So they are state-of-the-art at this point. And there are many competitors to them as well. But they're the one that comes to mind.
So from a B2B strategy point of view, one of the big challenges that I've kind of faced in the past many times is there's a fear of exposing your crown jewels, of basically being transparent about what you do with privacy and security, because if it's not perfect, then you are displaying to the world your issues. So the obvious reaction is, let's just say nothing. And they make it very opaque. It's really hard to find anything and you just get long documents and there's a lot of friction involved later down the line. In my view, you either do that or you do the fully transparent approach and just put everything out there and say, here's what we do.
There's a middle ground.
Talk to me about the middle ground.
There's a middle ground. So the first off is it's not only a corporate attitude, it's actually cultural. So you'll find certain places in Europe, as an example, where they're very, the default, China, the default is non-disclosure, where like the American side is a mix, but oftentimes it is, let's be transparent. Finland's the same way, let's be transparent. So the middle ground between having the crown jewels out for display and not saying anything is in my view, that's really what a certification and a third-party audit will do for you, because it says we have, there's a very popular industry standard, and we adhere to that, and we get audited by a third party, and that standard covers all of these really interesting things like firewalls and data privacy and what have you. And we don't necessarily have to share that material with you, but at least you have confidence that it's not just us, it's not just our marketing team saying, yeah, we take care of this. It is, hey, we've been audited by a third party, and this licensed third party has said, yes, they handle and they take care of these to the satisfaction of the standard. And it's, and that also, and so you have that from a marketing aspect. And so what I've seen is that just having the piece of paper, here's the AOC, the attestation of compliance for PCI, here is my SOC 2 report, cuts down a massive amount of questions, because now they're like, oh yeah, listen, I just wanted to verify. I just need to tick that box. You've got the piece of paper. Thanks very much. Where do I sign? Take my money. And that's what we want, right? We want to lower the barrier to entry. We want to lower the friction for security and compliance for customers. And to do that, we have to reduce their angst, their anxiety. We have to reduce their worries and having that third party. And it doesn't necessarily matter for most customers whether what the standard is. It could be ISO 27000, it could be SOC 2, it could be PCI, it could be something else that you pick up.
Just so you mentioned about vendor management there, and I wanted to know if you had any tips about not necessarily what you do or don't do, but what you could recommend to people in terms of, let's face it, most organizations do not do any due diligence or management of their suppliers, because it's hard and it costs money. That's the simple reason. But if they wanted to start and they wanted to start vetting, let's say, new suppliers that they were trying to onboard, should they be asking for a pen test that's under a year old? Should they be asking them to fill in a form that they'll just lie in? Are there any kind of good bits of advice you'd recommend that at least gets you a bit further forward?
Yeah, so this vendor management is a really interesting subject. And before I answer the question, let me step back a moment. And if you think about, not necessarily a day in my life, but a day in the life of most privacy security groups, you spend about 80% of your time in this, what I call maintain area, right? You're maintaining what you've got, maintaining the security, maintaining the privacy, maintaining all of the controls. And then the rest of that 20% of the time is split up between, possibly improving what you've got, getting new metrics, improving the way you do things, adding new KPIs, that kind of thing. And then there's a small one at the very bottom, which is get something new. Like, we're going to get a new certification. We're going to get something, a new standard, a new compliance. So you spend most of the time in maintain. And honestly, maintain is often boring. unless you're in security and you're doing, red team, blue team kind of thing, or purple teams where you're doing hacking and stuff each other, attack and defend. It really kind of gets sort of boring. Oh my goodness, I got to talk with these 18 vendors today. So vendor management is out of that 80%, vendor management, at least in my life, is a huge chunk of that time. It's not 80% of the 80%, but it's a big chunk of that time. And so how do you deal with that? So when you look at a vendor in particular, you're really interested in probably two main topics. And the first topic is just regular compliance-oriented items. Do they have a good privacy notice? Is their terms of service good? Are they GDPR compliant? Are they CCPA compliant if they're serving California? Are they PETA compliant, right? And that's what that side looks at, the compliance piece. And then the security side, you're looking, well, how secure are they? Do we trust them with our data? Do we trust them with personal data? What's the likelihood that they're going to get hacked? And so again, you're looking at risks for both of these, right? Do they comply, and what's the level of risk if they don't? And what's their security posture? And so after doing this for a while, there's really two different ways on the security side for people to think about this. And the first is to go spend money on tooling that will give an independent risk score, or perhaps you send out your own security questionnaire, like I send out my own security questionnaire. I've gotten to that point where it's worthwhile for me to understand a little bit about how the vendor works so that I can get a better picture. But what I've discovered over the years is when you look at those vendor questionnaires and when you look at the companies that do companies like Risk Recon and Security Scorecard and stuff, that they actually go out and they scan and then they come back and they have a vendor database. What they're really looking at is the same set of questions that are driven from the same sort of standards that I've been mentioning all the time long. You know, like we've mentioned, like ISO 27000, SOC 2, PCI, et cetera. And so the light bulb went off and said, you know, if they're active, they have an active SOC 2 security questionnaire, because SOC 2 has 5 trust service criteria, and the one that you have to get that's mandatory out of those is security. And then there's add-ons to that, like availability and privacy. And so you know that when they have SOC 2 or if they have PCI or they have ISO 27000, what that means at a very detailed level is going to be different. ISO 27000, very governance focused, PCI, rather so technical focused. But you know that they've been audited. You know that the same level of controls, for the most part, have been touched upon. And so you can, as we were talking about earlier, you can get that sense of confidence, those warm fuzzies that you're looking at, that there's something behind this. Like they're not just a fly by night. They have 2-factor authentication turned on. You know, they encrypt at rest. They encrypt transport. So that's a nice way of being able to put a yardstick. I guess that's the right way to say it, right? So it's a security yardstick. And then from there, you evaluate whether or not you need to go deeper or not. Do we have a requirement that this vendor become PCI? Yes or no? Well, they have SOC 2, but they're not PCI, and we need PCI. So it's that middle ground, I guess, is where. So I always try to go for the middle ground, because the middle ground is kind of easy, because it allows you to see both sides of the equation, right? It allows you to see the marketing and sales team, people who are really anxious to use this new tool that hoovers up personal data like it's going out of style. And then you have the other side, which is the compliance side. By the way, apologies to my sales team for watching. You have this other side with security where you're trying to say, well, wait a second, we need to adhere to compliance targets, GDPR. We need to make sure that we're adequately protecting personal data, because in GDPR, you are responsible for all of your vendors. If they have a breach, it's on you. So.
Yeah, I mean, that's fantastic insight there into the kind of the wide coverage, because there's not many people that really do get that level of exposure to the different frameworks, the different regulations, the different standards, the different certifications and audit processes that go on. I read a blog from you that you'd done a while back about SOC 2. And one of the interesting things you mentioned in there is that it can be really expensive to do, and it might not be of any value to you. So going back to one of your earlier points where you were saying about do what kind of makes sense for the business, keeps both the privacy and the security people or teams in line with the execs, and it means it's going to succeed, hopefully, and get that kind of corporate sponsorship. One of the interesting trends I've seen recently is, and it's going to blow a lot of people, privacy people's minds, is ISO 27701. And what I found really interesting about it is that the whole point of it is it's reliant and completely reliant on the existence of 27001 in place already. So essentially, to build a privacy information management system, you must have an information security version as well. And that's because it borrows so much of it. It's completely reliant on security. And I think many of us in privacy, firstly, are slightly hostile to that, because we see security as this tiny part of privacy rather than its like underpinnings. But the fact it's kind of now going to merge almost two things together creates some really interesting issues for people like you, because it's saying that your privacy system and your security system are going to be potentially together in one. Now, how does that manifest when you've got almost a privacy and security separation? Do you think they're going to get a lot closer because they need to, or are you going to keep them more separate?
At the risk of offending every single privacy lawyer out there, I will say that they cannot be separate. They have to be very closely co-joined, married at the hip, use whatever term you want to. You cannot do privacy without some level of tactical security measures in there. And I think we all recognize that, right? We're all smart people. The question I think really with ISO 27001 and 27701, it's really interesting because what you're looking for as a company when you're brand new, you want to find the fastest onboarding path. Like, how do I get from nothing, or maybe I have something, but how do I prove that I have something to everyone else? And when 27701 came out, we were all like, oh yeah, GDPR codified and an ISO standard. This is fabulous. Oh, wait, you mean I can't just use these 80 questions on my site? I have to do this other, oh my goodness. You mean I got to spend, you know, $10,000 every year, $100,000 every year just to be able to, and then I have this extra. It doesn't work that way. And that scares people. But as you were saying, Carl, it's right. You have to have those two together. And that's what I was talking about. You have to have the security and the privacy teams together. So there are easier onboarding paths to a certified something that will pass the smell test for a privacy program that does involve security. One of the interesting ways, as an example, I mentioned SOC 2 earlier. SOC 2 has 5 trust service criteria. One of those trust service criteria is privacy. Not as intense, not as laborious as 27701. However, and you have to have, just like 27701, you have to have the corresponding security module. So SOC 2, you have to have the security trust service principle. Not as bad, nowhere near as bad, or intensive, I should say, as 27,000. But you have that security piece, and then you just have this little writer. So it's the same sort of philosophy, same sort of implementation that you'd have with ISO 27,000. But it's easier to obtain. And then the nice thing you can do if you have a really wonderful auditor is that they can go and they can ask those questions, those privacy questions as part of SOC 2, and gear them toward whatever you're trying to achieve. Are you going for GDPR? Are you going for CCPA? Are you going for Pipedda? They can change those questions slightly so that they ask those probing questions, and in the comments field down at the bottom, they can put a mapping. I've asked this question. This is the GDPR version. This is the SOC 2 piece, and so it will demonstrate in your report that yes, you know, we've covered this, and we've essentially had our entire privacy program audited. So we've audited against GDPR. We've audited against CCPA, and so it's a much easier lift. We say lift, right? It's a much easier lift. Much easier way to obtain it. And you see, when you start looking at what the industry is requiring, what they're asking for, sorry, I'm going to go off topic here. I hope you don't mind. When you look at different places, you see different standards being asked of different countries. And this is why having an option of our pride and joy of ISO 27000 versus something like SOC 2, you see different things. So in the United States, we see principally PCI and SOC 2 and CCPA. In most of Europe, we see GDPR and SOC 2, tiny little bits of local laws. Like, for example, in France, you have Sectum Cloud, which is a big national. It's equivalent of the United States is FedRAMP, essentially. In the United States, we also have HIPAA, so we see HIPAA regulations. In France, we see HDS, which is it's actually more like HITRUST. So the HITRUST standard is healthcare protection coupled basically with ISO 27000 behind it. So you see the ISO 27000 appearing in a lot of different places, which is what makes it interesting. But it's usually, especially for smaller organizations and startups, it's just unattainable. They do not have this commercial driver, this incentive. I mean, they're going to lose money to go spin this up, and they're not going to have the ROI on the back end. So they need something similar. It would be really interesting if ISO 27701 could be used as a standalone, like they're an entry level, here's the privacy program, follow these tips. We don't really have that. You know, we have GDPR, we have CCPA, we have, right? We end up going against the law, but it's not really a standard at which you can be audited against. And that's kind of the big thing, right? Because we're looking for this trust, right? We want to be able to, we want our customers to have trust in us. And the primary way that I advocate to do that is by getting this third-party audit done against your program. So you don't have to take our word for it. Take our auditor's word for it.
And how do you kind of articulate that publicly? I imagine you've got some marketing people that are on you very, very tightly in terms of what you can talk about publicly. Like we all have, you know, that's fact of life, especially PR people, you know, I kind of fully get that. But do you, in the companies you've worked at, do you like to kind of put it out there about the kind of culture that's inside the company? Do you like to kind of talk about the stuff you do, or do you like to more like to let it be passive and let them come to you, but and then provide good answers? You know, do you like to talk about the culture of privacy and security within, let's say, platform publicly?
So I love to talk about it, and I do talk about it. Whether or not my marketing team and the sales team want me to might be a different story. I think they're really nice people, so I think they actually probably want me to talk more about it than I do. The way that I start off and frame these is actually a little simpler. So way to keep you out of jail. And instead of talking about the internal dynamics, right? Because you sometimes there's always going to be dirty laundry. There's things that didn't go quite well the first time. You know, it's like having a pen test report. You get a pen test report. There's always something you're going to say, I don't agree with this. I'm going to go fight back at the pen test and say, no, this is wrong. This is why. At the same time, you have a customer asking, hey, give us your pen test report. Well, we don't want to give them the pen test report because it's got some things in there that we think are wrong. We don't want to set the wrong expectation. We want to get it fixed and it's right. So the way that I do it is I talk about teams and roles typically, right? I talk about I have a security team and this is the functions that security team does, you know, and they're certified CISSP people. And then I have the compliance team and what their role is. And oh, by the way, they're also certified. They're CIPP/E. And so then that becomes a conversation of I have not just a single person. I have this function that are credentialed, that carry out activities in service of not only our clients, but in service of adhering to public standards. And so when you hear that, you have this picture of, hey, these guys might actually know what they're doing. You know, I might have some confidence in this because, you know, they've got somebody that's addressing these things. They've got somebody who's looking at this. They're checking all of their vendors to make certain, right? So you by doing that, you know, you bypass all the little stuff that always happens in every, you know, internally. And you know, because again, the certification pathways that what you're doing is at least as adequate as the standard that you're trying to achieve. And the more standards you have, you would think that the more adequate you have. Now, a lot of these standards have overlapping requirements, overlapping controls, you know, but still there's differences between them. There's value in each of these as well.
And I think the one word that kind of sums up that you mentioned that kind of sums up the whole of that answer really was the word confidence. It sounds like you're going for the confidence approach of people can say, yeah, they have credibility. We have confidence in them based on what we can see straight off.
I use the word trust. Trust is trust is the one I use. And I think about it in two different terms. I think about it as a trust package and a trusted environment. Or a trusted cloud even, right? And your trust package is the documentation, which includes all the certifications and includes some level of detail into how you've taken security, how you've designed security and how you've designed privacy into your product. So you have, this is what we've done. These are the attestations that, you know, we've been audited on that said we comply to a standard. You can trust us. We're not going to steal all of your data. We're not going to, you know, we're hopefully not going to have a breach. You know, you've got some reassurance. You've got some trust that we've done. We've taken it at the very baseline, reasonable and prudent measures to prevent that. And then when you look at that as a whole, then you have a trusted product. And that's ultimately what you're going for. So this confidence is good. Confidence actually is a good one because that's confidence is actually the French term of instead of trust, they use the term, these words, essentially confidence. So,
and I know trust has worked very well for Microsoft. They've got their trust center, haven't they? And they've always been very out there. I remember when GDPR came along and they had their like Microsoft.com/GDPR. They did that really early on and just said like, hey, this is what we're doing. This is why you can trust us. This is why you can be confident that Microsoft is a kind of a partner you want to work with. I imagine because you must have a very tech pushed company, like you've probably got some very techie founders, that there's kind of pressure from the likes of people like Netflix, from some of those tech firms where they, you know, they're proud of their breaches. I mean, Cloudflare is a great example. It's like, hey, we've been breached. We screwed up, guys. Here's how. And we didn't fire the guy. We actually promoted him. No, you didn't. You fired him. But yeah, anyway, the PR talk person said, we've promoted him. And they'll get Matthew Prince, the CEO, on, and he'll say how great they are. And they've screwed up again. And it was DNS and BGP again. And they'll always say the same kind of thing and almost create this kind of idea that full transparency about tech details, about screw-ups, is the way you build trust. And personally, I get this, get the strategy that, you know, that it's like a pit stop in Formula One. They're really fast at their pit stops. But I kind of also would like to get the confidence that they're not going to keep breaking down. So it's it must be a real challenge.
Yeah, it's interesting. The examples you referenced reek of marketing spin, right? Because nobody, the people may argue with me about this. That's fine. But my perception is nobody is going to be proud of a security. The first thing they're going to do is start swearing. How could, and because they're mad at themselves. And, you know, good organizations, ours internally, we get mad because we let customers down, even if the customers don't know it, right? And so we beat ourselves up about it. And that's the way most competent security people are going to be about. The same with compliance, the same with privacy. Like, oh, goodness, mea culpa. All right, listen, we need to go fix this. How do we do this? And then as part of that, you follow, you know, a lessons learned. You do a root cause analysis, you do a lessons learned. And then you take those lessons and you take, the, you know, from that you've gotten from the root cause and you ticket them in your ticket system. And then you make them as high a priority as reasonably possible with all the other things that are going on. And then you go close them. So you will never have a repeat occurrence. And if you have a repeat occurrence, it's like, whoa, 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 stop the presses. Let's go hit the emergency off button. What the heck is going on? We need to fix this. And so those are interesting. The more disruptive challenges are when you get an emergency kernel patch or oh my goodness, Intel's got another thing going on and we have to patch everything. And we've had on those that cases, we've had horrendous luck to protect the names of some of our partners. We've had one case where patches to that, so our underlying infrastructure providers have, you know, done a little rolling cadence. They let us know things were great. It's the same thing that we do. We let our customers know this region is going to go down for an emergency security patch. We're going to try to do it when you're at low business. Please bear with us. Here's the reasons why we're doing it. We're trying to take care of you and protect you. We've had other providers that have just said, yep, let's pull the plug. And they yanked everything and they take it down for 6 hours while they go apply patches. And we're like, not a very good relationship management tactic there. So dealing with emergency patches thankfully doesn't happen very often, and so that's really the other big thing that you worry about. You worry about it from a privacy side because, you know, if there's a security exposure, you could expose personal data, and you worry about the security side too, because, you know, you want to make certain that things are patched. You want to have, you know, good clean scans, but you just don't want people to get in through the front door. You don't want them to get through the firewall. You don't want to get them through all the protective barriers, this defense in depth that we utilize. And so how do you do that? And that's patch management and how a company does patch management, specifically around security patches, how quickly they update, how do they update? Those are some of the really telling questions if you can get that response out. Like in our case, just to be right, we go through and we build on a very regular basis, and we produce images or repos depending on the product, and then anytime a customer deploys, they always pick up the latest packages, especially on our grid program. So from that point of view, we can assure customers that if they want the latest security patches, they just have to deploy their code. And oh, by the way, if you've already got a cron job out there to update your SSL certificates on a regular basis, you're automatically deploying and you're automatically getting the security updates.
So. I mean, you're singing to the choir there. I have the unfortunate experience of having done a lot of work in banks, and that's a nightmare because of this thing called change management, which nobody ever teaches you about in school. Because, hey, agile, whatever that means. So there's a kind of a challenge now that patch management is this thing that we kind of throw around of just like, hey, deploy this fix, whether it be a security thing or a privacy thing, that is, well, it's as easy as that. I mean, a classic question in privacy is, you've spotted a flaw in the way things are being done in a company and you need to update the privacy policy. Well, how the hell do you do that? Because you can't just kind of slip it in. It's same with a kind of a B2B contract. You can't just slip it in there. You may have to kind of notify people, but if you notify them, then what's the blowback going to be? So do you actually just try and slip it in there anyway, or do you not bother? And you've got all these kind of ethical, moral issues, and clearly the privacy, especially the DPO person, is going to say, just do it. That's my formal advice. But how? And for a company, it's incredibly difficult and virtually sometimes impossible to do, so they just won't do it. So things do get swept under the carpet. And a question for you about that is, how do you think we can help people understand good ways of approaching patch management or fix management, and intercepting the whole incident management turning into kind of change management, about how you actually get things done to make things better?
Continuous integration. That's part of the answer. It's not the
what
full
does
answer.
That mean?
That means you're always building. Every time you submit a branch, the branch goes through, it does all of your unit tests, your functional tests, and you're basically building the product every single time you run it looking for problems. And so you know, the good news about that is that you know when there's going to be a problem. You know, if your changes don't work, you'll know about it pretty quickly. So you have this, so I split this in a couple different areas because it's different for different companies, right? If you have a company that relies on that has a very important business product, and that business product can't be down, it has to have very high uptime, then those companies typically are implemented in one of two ways. The first way is that it is a monolithic system. It may have some load balancers, right, some stuff like that. But that's it. They're just sort of this older school style. And then you have the newer one, which is more fault tolerant, which is not only do they have load balancers for various different things, they have a distributed high availability item so that they can take pieces of their infrastructure down that's serving their product, but not the whole product itself. And they can begin to update and roll. And if they see a problem, they could roll those back again, fix whatever might have happened in the meantime. And meanwhile, you suffer minimal to no downtime. So there's two different ways of approaching this. When you have the more monolithic style, you end up having change control teams. And so you have to, you know, here's the change, and we want to apply this vendor change, we want to apply this product change. Okay, let's go get it reviewed. What was the QA like? How long was it tested? And, you know, 4 weeks later, we might actually get deployed, and it requires a 16-hour downtime. Well, I mean, not that long, actually more, but, you know, 12-hour downtime to do this. So there's a fundamental shift in how you design the product. Most, and this is one of the driving reasons, I might add, for people to migrate to the cloud. You still have these problems in the cloud, but it's one of the reasons why people migrate to the cloud, to build these more highly available, less susceptible to outages and problems, more easily updatable products. So when you're dealing with these changes, you really have those two different types. And if you're on the old model, there's not much you can do except to begin to slowly retool, rethink, redesign, or outsource. I suppose that's an option as well.
Yeah. So you've done some great plugs for your own company there, and bravo. I'm sure you're going to get a bonus on Monday for the kind of work you've been doing. But like, I'm glad you have, because one of the things I love is to get people to really talk genuinely and honestly about the challenges and how real products, real solutions, and real companies do actually benefit that. And it sounds like Platform is one of those. Have you got any other tips or resources or bits of technology that you just like to extol the virtues about that you just are a complete fanboy for?
I'm going to go for concepts as opposed to tools.
Wow, that's a really, really dull answer, but I'll take it.
we could always market the tool du jour, and there's a wide number of really good tools. There's tools that people market that you find out when you start using them don't perform up to their expectations. And then you have service organizations like, who's your auditor? Ooh, this is great. You know, in my case, I'm really fortunate. I've got a really nice auditor. They're a wonderful team. Risk 360. Okay, thank you. I didn't get paid for that, but I'll shoot them a line. But I'll talk about concepts, and I think that there's there's a couple concepts that I believe are important. And the first one, which is at the core of every, should be at the core of every modern organization, is automation. Right. In the past, when we didn't have computers, we did things on, you know, everything, bookkeeping, et cetera, was on pieces of papers, general ledgers, big pile of books that, you know, the people would have the bookcases with all the material behind them, the filing cabinets that go on forever. And we slowly moved away from that. And we've gotten pretty good at doing this, but we still have some things that we just, we don't yet know how to programmatically check, right? If what we could use, so we have the automation. So the first part of automation is making sure that you do all of your, from the security side, make sure you do all of your checks, your pen, your internal testing, your vulnerability scanning that you can do internally. Like, try to automate all of that material so that you've got it done. Yep, that's a check mark. Everything looks great from there. So, because that gives you the sense of confidence. And then the other piece is, which is actually more interesting for the privacy folks that are watching, is how do you automate privacy? What is privacy ops? And what is this new thing that people are talking about called compliance ops? And compliance ops really is just a component of privacy, right? Privacy is one piece of compliance. And how do you go through, and how do we scan? How do we look for, as I just had the conversation yesterday, how do you look for API calls that are in your product? And can you map what you're using in that API back to the standard contractual clauses of the DPA that you signed that list those things, and then highlight, oh goodness, I'm sending along three different things that I wasn't expecting to send across, and I don't technically have it, you know, in my SCCs or my DPA. And then how do you look at, you know, do you even have these things? Do you have an NDA? So how do you pull all these things? And so we're starting to see a number of companies begin the hard intellectual work. A couple of the really exciting pieces are using machine learning for this, to be able to build this so that you can run something in the background and get details. And those details to a privacy lawyer that sits off in the legal division that is completely separated from the developers or any of the product divisions, right? That they can get something that's somewhat intelligible to them that they can then use to just double check to make sure that they've covered it. Because that's really one of the hardest spots from a privacy professional point of view, is how do I know what's going on? It's easy if you're a small startup. It's very difficult if you're in an organization that manages 100 products, 500 products, that has a fleet of 1,000 websites. How do you do this? How do you know that for each single one? I mean, that's like a never-ending nightmare. You'd never be able to get to the depth in each one of these that you really want to in order to give just yourself confidence that things are done. And so what are these privacy professionals doing? They're taking a risk-based approach. What does my personal data look like here? What does my exposure look like? What's my risk surface? So automation I think is one. And then the other component really is what I mentioned earlier, which is see how much, do risk-based and figure out how you can tie it to revenue. And then what does that really mean? And that leaves out, unfortunately, a lot of privacy lawyer issues, such as, I have this new law coming in. Do I need to comply? What does the compliance look like? I have to go through an evaluation. What do I do? I've evaluated. It means we need to do these 18 things. How do I know if I don't have exposure? How do I know if I've done those? How do I know if we're doing those as a company? And then you need to have this whole process and planning. And so those are probably the biggest challenges I think you'd find in, you know, from the privacy side of the shop, is just making sure that you've been able to dot the I's, cross the T's.
So have we heard it here first? Are you coining the phrase DevPrivOps?
I don't know if I can. I probably would coin that. You might have just coined it now, Deb.
No, I think I'm going to give that one to you, because in about 2 years we're going to be hearing it everywhere, and it's going to kill me. But yeah, that is definitely a Jerry Stanford one. DevPrivOps.
We have to go that way, because what's going to happen? So I have this thing. Sorry, Carl. I don't think I've introduced you to my crystal ball. Here's my crystal ball. And my crystal ball is usually accurate. Right? It predicted the failure of Safe Harbor. It predicted the failure of Privacy Shield, although my prediction came true a year and a half later than I predicted it, but it still came true. And so I have this, my prediction is, as the couple predictions. The first is that we're going to see, as privacy kind of catches on, as we get the big Facebook and the Google and these various things were copious amounts of data. Finally, people are starting to understand, right? Target breached, hundreds of thousands of records and yeah, right, whatever. But now, you know, it's Facebook. Oh my God, here's Facebook, Facebook's great. Cambridge Analytical, people are panicking and now right this way. So you're seeing privacy laws that either didn't exist before, come in on the books to be voted on. You've seen places where they've been stalled and now see them coming to light in some cases very dramatically, like in Brazil that happened. You know, they went from not having a privacy law to having something to not having anything to it being in effect later to not having anything to all of a sudden it's in effect again. I mean, just this roller coaster of a ride. You even see places where countries like China that get a lot of criticism for their intelligence operations. I guess that's probably the right way to say it. Much like the U.S. U.S. is on the stage today. You know, you see them even caring about privacy. So you're going to see more. We're going to see more and more of this, which creates this uneven landscape. You know, if you want to do business in a country, you have to adhere to the privacy laws of that country. So we think back. I'll take you on a little journey. As we think back at the GDPR, before GDPR, in Europe, we had the Data Privacy Directive. And this Data Privacy Directive was essentially born of the fact that as Europeans, we care about what happens to our data. You know, hands off. This is not your business, right? We don't want this. But it had an interesting effect. And the interesting effect was the directive said, you know, each member state, thou shalt implement your own data privacy law, and it should follow these standards, these guidelines. And so people did, you know, the UK implemented one, and then, right, and somebody, the Germans implemented something different, right? So you have all of these that are implemented, and what the discovery was, the first one was it didn't go far enough. That's great. Pro-privacy people were like, we want more. But when you start looking at where it really matters in terms of getting things done, that's at the trade level, the commerce level. And what you found was if I was in the United Kingdom, for example, and I wanted to do business in France, I had to adhere to one set of laws. And if I wanted to go to Germany, I had to do some stuff that not only was data protection directive, but some additional work. And so it set up these boundaries of commerce boundaries of doing business. And that was a huge incentive because of the complaints, a huge incentive to try to fix that. And that's where you find, right, the data protection directive going into the GDPR, which is an actual regulation that says, ha, you're doing it this way now. And then of course we find that the Germans say, this is great, but it's not enough. Let's add BDSG Neu to that. And so now we have some extra, but we count that aside, right? We've more or less smoothed out the commerce playing field for data protection in the EU. And UK. But now you're looking at, if you look out to the rest of the world, you're saying, well, this is a little lumpy. We've got something maybe going on. India, China's got its own things going. Brazil just passed this. Singapore's got another one here. Look at the United States. Holy cow. Right. And so you have all these things out, and it's a very uneven landscape. And this is where ISO 27701 sort of missed the boat somehow, right? It would have been great to say, so ISO 27701 more or less codifies GDPR. GDPR currently is our most restrictive privacy standard, you could argue. There's comments you could say against that, but generally you consider it the gold class standard. It still has several holes. It's not quite like Swiss cheese, but there's a bunch of them in there that we want to patch, and we'll get there, right? But how do we enable business? How do we enable smooth commerce transactions while limiting compliance burden, limiting audit burden across the rest of the world? And that's our big challenge today. And so when people ask me, I've got a privacy program, how do I deal with this on an international basis? My answer is typically, if GDPR is one of the things you're thinking about, start with GDPR. It's going to be hard. It's going to be a lot harder in many cases than some other places, but it gives you basically the top level, right? The top bar, and then you can use that when you've met GDPR, you can then go out to all these other rules and say, oh, all right, let's go to Canada. Canada's got Pipetta and the Canadian anti-spam law. Do we comply? Well, I have GDPR, so I basically comply with this. I only have this 5% extra piece I have to do, so it's a small lift. It's a small change, right? I go to Australia. Okay, GDPR, Australia. I'm pretty good. I have to make some privacy policy changes. Okay, well, that's fine. I can do that. You know, that's privacy policy versus a whole lot of other stuff. I can handle that. And so, you know, then you can start using that. And then as you add these little extra snippets from these other different laws, the hope would be that that you would be able to, by the time you're done, you have something that will essentially apply to all the regulations with minimal or no lift past that. And we see that in most cases. There are a couple left field things that show up where it's mostly GDPR, but it has this very special condition to it. The place that's been a bit challenging, I think, for everyone has been California with the California Consumer Protection Act, partly because it's a moving target, partly because what resulted in the standard has a lot of gray in it. That one I would call more Swiss cheese. And it introduced, even though they based it on, they tried to use GDPR as a model, they didn't succeed all that well in a sense because they've introduced a whole lot of different terms. So in GDPR, we talk about controller and processor and variations of that. In CCPA, we're talking about a consumer. And a consumer has a very specific definition, and then there's a difference between the statute and then the actual regs that go into place, and so it's a bit confusing for people. And of course it really hurts people because, unlike the GDPR, well, GDPR really bothered marketing people, right? Because now I can't, what do you mean I gotta have consent to get this? How am I gonna do cold calling? How am I gonna do sales outreach? I mean, I don't know how to, right? Now you have this whole do not sell piece, which ruins a whole bunch, a lot of people's day. So it's very difficult. So we're going to see, my prediction, my crystal ball says we are going to see, we're going to continue to see a little bit of patchwork in the United States. And then eventually we will have, at some point, my rough guess is about 2.5 years, we will begin to see the beginnings of an actual privacy law for the United States. And we're going to see, as these new privacy laws pop up in other countries, we're going to see them modeled on the GDPR. So we're not going to have this smooth ISO 27701 defined playing field, this GDPR playing field, but we'll have something that's close. And so that's, again, why I recommend starting with GDPR first if you can, because it provides, it's very difficult, especially when you're looking at marketing and sales, because of the impacts on that. And that's a very difficult conversation to have. And because of that, you need to have a good justification to get into doing that.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more with that strategy. The GDPR even just gives you a language to use internally. When you're getting really into the weeds of even CCPA, you'll find a lot of US lawyers will be using data controller, data processor as their language, because it just makes things really clear. Clear, and when you're abiding by that, it starts to make even CCPA compliance even easier. So codifying that, it's interesting with ISO 27701 how they've used a lot of that GDPR language but also completely butchered some of the language as well. I think one of the classic ones is data principal, and a data principal is actually a person, an individual. So so well done for the clever people that came up with that one. But I couldn't agree more. Start with the GDPR and you'll be in a really good place. One last question for you, Jerry. I appreciate it's a Friday. I want to let you get off. Is jobs. Really interesting time right now in privacy, especially. I'm seeing a lot of people moving between jobs, being laid off, some companies hiring. I know one company that's hired a quarter of all of their staff have been hired during lockdown, so during the pandemic, so they've never met any of their colleagues. So, and we're talking hundreds there. So it's really changeable times. But at Platform, I believe you were, are you still looking for somebody?
I have job recs open for both security and compliance personnel at this time. And if my budget goes through for next year, there'll be more.
So could you talk about what you're actually, what you're looking for right now? Because I'm sure there's going to be some people watching, listening to this that are actively looking right now.
So I have, the security team and the compliance team. So the security team is looking for what we call a security engineer. And so what we've done is we've mapped out roles, and we're kind of unique in, maybe not that unique, but My fundamental principle is I'd like to adhere to a standard, surprise. I'd like for people to have vacations. I'd like for anyone on the team to go pick up. There's sort of a minimum bar, and then there's specializations that go beyond that bar. And so we're hiring on the security side. We're hiring for this minimum bar, and it's really the equivalent of if somebody is certified with ISC squared, CISSP, that sort of more tactical background that has works with Linux, knows Linux containers, worked with cloud hosting providers such as AWS, Azure, Google Cloud Platform, right? That's the kind of skill set we're looking for, you know, Linux, containerized, Python, Go, to be able to go look at. And then once they get started for us, it's a little interesting because most people, when they say, hey, listen, we're going to put an orchestration layer in, you know, they think Kubernetes or even OpenStack. In our case, we run our own. So you have to go learn our own and how that works and how things are structured. So that's the security side. On the compliance side, right now I've got, today I've got a senior compliance person, senior compliance specialist. It's an interesting name. So I went with compliance specialist, and people always say, what's a compliance specialist? Because when you look at a compliance officer, if you go to Indeed, Glassdoor, LinkedIn, right, compliance officer really means somebody that's in like a healthcare or very regulated, and they're just looking at very, it's not doing anything toward what we would consider to be traditional privacy, traditional standards. It's something completely different. But a compliance specialist is the one that seems to be a standard activity. And so you have different levels in there, right? So you have like that and different specializations. But at the base level, I have the same principle there on the, as a security team where everyone knows how to do everything else. And that includes the dreaded vendor management component. And reading contracts and reading DPAs and answering client questions and processing DSAR requests and handling, GDPR deletion requests and all of those various different pieces. And so that piece is interesting for me. I'm looking for somebody that actually has done this before that's not going to be starting out fresh. And I have this little secret goal. I've told some people about it, but I haven't told everyone, but I'll do it now, is that I'm my ideal is if I find the right person for this job, what I'd really like to do is train them as a DPO and not have to do my job. I like redundancy, right? And so what's really nice about it is as you have, I have redundancy in security, I have a redundancy in compliance. And boy, is it great to have a junior DPO or even a senior DPO. And then you can have specialties off of that. Like it's about time that I get a privacy lawyer. right now I'm relying on a number of different law firms to provide some advice when and other people for free advice when I come across things that I just don't know exactly which way I want to tackle or if I don't have the experience in it. So,
yeah. And thank you for Cyber Solicitor, who I do actually know, who's based in the north of England, that he's got a lot of experience in the privacy world and security, especially. He's saying one of the things he's seeing is a lot of attention around building privacy teams, and that's very much in your camp right now. If I had to ask you, what was the one skill that you would love to see from the person that is applying, one bit of experience, one skill? What is something that delights your heart when you see that people have it?
Sadly, I'm sorry, Carl, I can't narrow it down to one. I can narrow it down to a small number.
I'll give you one that I like to see, and it's sales experience. And I know it sounds ridiculous, but I'll say it. Hey, being able to sell is a interpersonal kind of skill. It requires emotional intelligence, and it's vital when you work in privacy and security to be able to sell the reason, the value of what you need doing in to make things better, to change something, to improve it, to generate that business case. Because patch management is a perfect example where half the security industry for the last 10, 20 years has been complaining that nobody listens to them, but at the same time complaining that salespeople are idiots. You know, well, there's a kind of a mismatch there. We need to be able to convince people that are running companies that, hey, it's a good idea to do something, and sales skills are part of that.
Yep. But when you think about the sales piece, the piece that's targeting really is the more outward facing of the compliance people. And then when you get to sort of the inward internal audit, a lot of the maintain like vendor management. Like my auditors actually love to see when they recommend to other people about their privacy and compliance teams, they love to see people that have specialties in public accounting. I was like, public accounting, really? So yeah, if you think about it, they have a set of codified laws that they have to follow. They're very good at detail. They can make sure that things line up. They can run all the reports necessary. They're very diligent, and they rarely make any mistakes. because there's severe consequences. And I'm like, you know, that's a really good idea. I like that, right? And you know, the other component that I really like is actually, and I'll put a plug in for IAPP.org. I am not an IAPP member, but I use them as one of my principal news sources for privacy because they're just so good at it. And actually in my job requirements for compliance, I put in their certification, CIPP, usually CIPP/E. Highly recommend them. They're easy to get into as well, right? Because in most cases, like the certifications that I have, so I have a certified information security manager and a certified data privacy solutions engineer. For both of those, the ones that I have, you have the test on the body of knowledge, and then you have, you know, 4 to 5 years of real work experience. That has to be signed off, in my case, by my employer. So you can't just pencil whip it, as they would say. With IAPP, it's really nice because you're really being tested just on the body of knowledge. So it's a much lower barrier of entry. You can go in and pass the test, learn about privacy in the specific jurisdiction. And oh, by the way, they have other different flavors of that too. It's not just for the privacy professional, but for, you know, for management, for technology. So I'll put a plug out for them because they do a really wonderful job, and I recommend them as well.
Fantastic. And where can people find out more about the openings that you've got in privacy and security?
Platform.sh, we have a careers page for that.
Fantastic. Awesome, well, awesome. Thank you very much, Jerry. That's been a super conversation. Thanks, really insightful to hear about the kind of the world you're in, and I guess what it's really like to be handling privacy and security in a big B2B, truly global environment. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Show notes for this episode are available on the website thegdprguy.com, and if you'd like any direct assistance with your privacy compliance, then please get in touch. I'll be happy to help. I've been your host, Carl Gottlieb. Thanks for listening.